Shirazi writes, Allah Khamenei says that enemies have been trying to advance their malicious political agenda by waging an economic war against the Iranian nation. Reports emerging of U.S. forces transferring hundreds of Daesh terrorists from a prison in northeast Syria to a desert near Iraqi border. And the UK says it will offer NATO a major deployment of forces and weapons in Eastern Europe over what it calls Russian hostility. It's good to have you with us. Our top story this hour, Iran's leaders saying that the enemies have been trying to advance their political plots against Iran through an economic war. Ayatollah Khamenei says an economic collapse was a prelude to wicked political goals. He said that the enemies tried to pit the Iranian people against the Islamic establishment. The leader cited the example of economic enterprises that have not tied their operations to the removal of sanctions, adding that Iran's economy should not be contingent on issues over which officials have no control. The leader made a comment during an address to a group of Iranian manufacturers. Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog is in the UAE for talks with leaders of the Arab country, greeting him in Abu Dhabi. Emirati Foreign Minister Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed held the visit as one more huge step toward a successful relationship. Herzog, the first Israeli president to visit the Sheikhim, will be meeting with top Emirate officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. The UAE, along with Bahrain, established diplomatic ties with Israel 2 years ago in U.S. broker deals. Palestinians consider normalization as a betrayal of their cause. Israeli media says that Herzog will use the two-day stay to encourage more Persian Gulf Arab countries to normalize with Tel Aviv. The trip follows another one by Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett in December. Now, the UK is planning to commit more forces and weapons to the NATO alliance for deployment in Eastern Europe amid rising tensions with Russia over Ukraine. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that the move will send a clear message to the Kremlin that London won't tolerate what he described as Moscow's destabilizing activities. The offer will be made to NATO military chiefs next week. The deployment will include warships, jets, and military equipment. Britain may also double its forces in Eastern Europe from the current 1,150. Relations between Russia and the West have been at their lowest since the Cold War. NATO insists that Russia has deployed tens of thousands of troops on the border in preparation for an invasion of Ukraine. Moscow says it has the right to move forces on its own soil because its security is at risk from NATO's eastward enlargement and military activities. The crisis over Ukraine keeps unraveling amid a stand-up between the U.S.-led NATO and Russia. The United States has already sent several batches of military supplies to Kiev. It's now planning to dispatch troops to Eastern Europe. Several U.S. allies have also put their forces on alert over what they call a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine. Corporate media, meantime, are portraying Moscow as an aggressor while ignoring how the West has threatened Russian security with military drills and weapons buildup near Russian borders.
Ukraine, a country in Eastern Europe, making the headlines these days as it remains a source of friction between its neighbor Russia and backers in the US-led NATO alliance. Corporate media have been trying to portray Russia as an aggressor, bombarding their audience with reports on the country's troop deployment at the border, its military drills, as well as moving blood supplies to Ukraine. Can the international community fall into yet another war trap in a scenario set by the West on a likely Russian invasion of Ukraine? But the question is, given the US-led NATO's eastward expansion and transfer of their lethal weapons and troops bases in Eastern Europe, which one is the real aggressor, NATO or Russia?
When the Soviet Union fell and the Warsaw Pact had already been ended, since then, NATO has added 14 more countries, and nearly all of them are countries that were either republics of the Soviet Union or allies of the Soviet Union.
Ukraine is simply a pawn on the Western chessboard. The U.S. has already sent several consignments of weapons as part of a multi-million dollar security aid to Ukraine while planning more troop deployment. America's allies, Britain, France, and others, have also put their forces on alert. The massive propaganda has even prompted the Ukrainian leader to urge his Western counterparts to avoid stirring panic over a Russia invasion. The West claims Russia is building up troops at the border to invade Ukraine. Moscow denies any such plan, saying its troop mobilization is simply defensive. It says the buildup also aims to counter NATO aggression. The military alliance has conducted several war games near Russian borders, three of them jointly with Ukraine, which is not even a member of the military alliance. So, what's the real game plan? Analysts believe the U.S. wants to integrate Ukraine into the American empire by granting it a NATO membership, a message hidden in Washington's response to Moscow's security proposals.
This makes the Russians see red spots before their eyes, the same way as any talk of Mexico, say, joining a Chinese military alliance would make them freak out in Washington. It's not a difficult problem.
Russia is seeking to reassert its place in the international arena, and its proposals for a diplomatic resolution to the Ukraine standoff seem reasonable. A possible military conflict between the European Union and Russia would entail massive human losses and economic harms. Undoubtedly, Russia has grown increasingly concerned about its security because of Western weapons and forces deployed to its doorstep. The corporate media have played a vital part in fueling tensions, and the U.S., that has waged numerous wars overseas, knows very well how dangerous provoking a war with Russia will be.
Time now for the news review section. New reports emerging of the U.S. role in northeastern Syria. American forces have transferred 750 Daesh terrorists, most of them foreigners, from a prison in Hasakah province. Russian media are quoting special sources as saying that the detainees have been transferred to a desert in Deir al-Zor province. They say U.S. coalition drones perform monitoring operations to secure their exit routes until they arrived at their destination near the town of Bukemo. Sources say the transfer process took place in batches by SUVs and buses. A number of top Daesh leaders holding Arab, Belgian, and Dutch nationalities were among the escapees. Last week, Daesh attacked the detention center. Heavy fighting then ensued. Kurdish-led forces, who are allies of the U.S., are fighting the Syrian government, and they are running the prison. Syria's UN envoy has blamed Washington for the clashes. Bassam Sabak says that the U.S. is seeking to recycle Daesh and justify American military presence in Syria. Now, to get some insight into that story, let me invite a couple of guests. We'll have our correspondent in Damascus, Mohammed Ali, joining us. Also, Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, is joining us out of Sydney. Let's first go to Damascus. Mohammed, give us some more information and what we hear in news reports regarding this transfer of Daesh forces by U.S.
Yes, Russian media reported that the United States transported 750 Daesh terrorists from Hasakah to the countryside of Deir al-Zor, mainly around Abu Kamal on the borderline between Syria and Iraq, and to area near Al-Bishri Mountain, also in Deir al-Zor's southern countryside. Now, according to reports, even the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces, which works with the United States over there, forces on the ground in Al-Hasakah, retreated from three positions around the Ghoiran prison, which Daesh attacked a week ago, and allowed terrorists to escape from those three positions towards two areas in Al-Hasakah where they gathered. Then the SDF helped them to get out and reach those areas in Deir al-Zor countryside. According to those reports by Russian media, also the U.S.-led coalition reconnaissance drones helped those Daesh terrorists and directed them to use special routes over there in that desert of Deir al-Zor to reach those areas. Now, this is definitely not the first time that cooperation between Daesh and the United States in that area of Syria is reported. Russia said it many times that even the United States is training directly those terrorists of Daesh in its illegal base of Al-Sanf on the borderline between Syria and Iraq, and also the Syrian government always officials know to that support of the United States to Daesh, and it says always that the United States wants to help Daesh to keep control in some areas in order to use that as a pretext to stay occupying Syria.
Okay. Now we have a clear picture. Now, let me ask Tim Anderson about what the U.S. is exactly is doing in Syria. We had that prison attack where, you know, Daesh inmates, some of them were able to flee, and then now we have the U.S. moving these terrorists. Maybe they call them good terrorists. I don't know. Every now and then, you know, definitions change. Good terrorists, bad terrorists, modern ones. So what's the U.S. exactly doing in Syria?
Well, Daesh has always been a creature of the U.S. to try and destabilize Syria and Iraq. It was created first in Iraq back in 2004, 2005, then exported to Syria in 2012. And there have been constant reports of U.S. direct collaboration with Daesh in Syria and Iraq from Syrian, Iraqi, and Iranian sources since 2014. Now, more recently, there were Syrian television reports of Daesh terrorists who were captured by the Syrians and confessed they'd come from the U.S. base in Al-Tanf to attack the Syrian army in Palmyra and the T4 air base. 3 months ago, there was a report of a number of Daesh families moved across to Iraq. So there are these constant reports, and the latest one, of course, is significant in that a large number of fighters have been moved down to the one border post in the border between Iraq and Syria, which is controlled by Iraq and Syria. So the U.S. has been launching missile attacks on that base for a long time, and also the bombing in Al-Baghouz was two years ago was linked to that too. So the latest thing is another step in a series of constant collaborations which the U.S. has tried to keep hidden, but clear direct collaborations with Daesh to try and keep destabilizing Syria and Iraq and to keep the two countries apart.
Okay, Tim, how can the U.S. say that? Because as you said, they were the ones who created groups like Daesh, and that's what Donald Trump alluded to, you know, Hillary Clinton and others during the Obama era. And then they launch the so-called war on terror. They fight what they call terrorists in some parts of the world, and then they go on in broad daylight, support them, and they're doing what they're doing now in Syria.
It's a larger scale of what's called a protection racket in U.S. terms. Basically, they demand that they be paid for protection, basically. And, of course, they're claiming their presence in Iraq and Syria to this day is to fight Daesh, when from the Syrian and Iraqi and Iranian sources, we know the relationship has been one of constant collaboration. So the problem is, of course, that in the propaganda war stakes, the U.S. media will never admit this. They never acknowledge this at all. Even when the massacre in Al-Baghouz was revealed by the New York Times some months ago, they claimed it was in the middle of the fog of war fighting ISIS in that same part of Syria that these 750 terrorists have now been sent to around the Al-Bukamal border crossing.
Right. Now let me ask Mohammed Ali about the Damascus government's posture regarding this, because I don't think that Damascus wants the U.S. forces to remain on Syrian soil.
Yes, for sure. The Syrian officials always stress that the presence of the U.S. forces in Syria is illegal. It is occupation of Syrian lands, and this is not something new. The Syrian government knows very well that there is a direct support by the United States to those terrorists of Daesh. For example, this time when they transported the 750 terrorists, where did they take them? They actually took them to an area called Al-Bukamal, around Al-Bukamal. Al-Bukamal is an area controlled by the Syrian army and its allies. So the United States is literally sending those troops as if they worked for them to fight the Syrian army. What the United States is doing is that it's actually portraying to the international community that it is fighting the terrorists Daesh terrorists, and its presence is for this purpose in Syria. But on the ground, what it's doing, it's directly supporting them in order to give itself a pretext to continue occupying Syria. Since 2014, when the U.S.-led coalition started intervening in Syria, and up till this moment, we never saw any defeat of Daesh in areas that the U.S.-led coalition operates. All we saw was destruction by U.S.-led coalition attacks to the infrastructure of the Syrian territories, whether in al-Raqqa or in areas in the north and northeast. We saw the killing of thousands of civilians because of such attacks by the U.S.-led coalition, and we're seeing the smuggling and the looting of Syria's national resources, the oil, from Syria to Iraq with the help of the so-called Syrian Democratic Forces. So definitely the Syrian government does know about what the United States is doing inside Syria. However, it has been always calling on the United Nations Security Council to take some kind of action or effort in order to stop such an occupation. However, up till this moment, we're still seeing silence, international silence, over such an occupation, because the United States is in Syria without a UN mandate, without the approval of the Syrian government. Thus, it is actually occupying Syria, destroying it, and also trying to loot its national resources.
Right. Now, Tim, speaking of Syrian oil, we remember former President Trump saying that we have done enough, we have defeated Daesh, let others take care of the rest. But U.S. forces did stay in Iraq in order to, what the U.S. officials called, to secure the oil there. Now, how much longer do you believe, and this is what the Damascus government is opposed to strongly, as Muhammad Ali just rightfully put it. So how much longer do you think the U.S. will stay in Syria? Will it ever leave Syria?
Yes, I believe it will, and it's a question of months, probably. I mean, the Biden administration had been in talks with the Russians late last year about the future of the SDF, their other proxy, the one that they substituted for Daesh effectively, but which has helped them control and release from time to time different groups of Daesh terrorists. They, of course, know that that Kurdish-led group is going to collapse completely when the U.S. withdraws. And, of course, the U.S. has already committed itself to withdrawing what they call combat troops from Iraq. So those two occupations are very closely linked. And the U.S. is trying, in my view, is trying to find a way out, just as Trump tried to find a way out, but facing the problem of how bad they're going to look when they do it. And I suppose one way of reading the dispersion of more Daesh terrorists is to say that, look, you know, when we're no longer there, Daesh is, there's an outbreak of Daesh without the U.S. there to suppress them. They'll try and run that line, I think, on their gullible press, which, after all, writes pretty much anything that they want them to write.
I appreciate your contribution. Muhammad Ali, our correspondent in Damascus. Tim Anderson, director of the Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies in Sydney.
Iranian Radio. Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from latter's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. These events form our history and we must learn from them. But a nation that is alive does not look only at the past, it also looks at the next step to be taken and the horizons ahead in every stage of its history. In accordance with the developments of its time and in accordance with the duties that fall on that nation, we must identify the task to be done at the present moment. We must determine our steps for the future. And we must identify the horizon, fix our eyes on it, and move towards it with all our strength and power. In this way, the movement will be successful in the real sense of the word. In addition, it will achieve the final victory, which is first of all a pure life for the Iranian nation. If others learn from it, and if it becomes a model, this is another issue. But we should achieve prosperity and an Islamic lifestyle, which is a pure life that has worldly comforts, has both religion and welfare, and is good for both the body and the soul.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
At the present time, we are in the middle of the path. Of course, part of the way has been travelled up until today. The Iranian nation has worked hard and we have moved forward a little. But we should identify what our duty is today and what our duty and horizons are for the future as well. Sometimes one sees that they carry out polls. For example, they ask the opinion of the people. But these things do not show the truth of the Iranian nation. The truth of the Iranian nation is shown by the funeral of Martyr Soleimani. It is these things that show the mood of the Iranian nation and what their sentiments and feelings are. In other words, in order to understand the reality and feelings of this nation, a domain as great and vast as the country and people of Iran is needed. Therefore, the polls that some groups carry out here and there, some of which have ulterior motives behind them, and some of which are innocent, cannot be a criterion in this regard.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
After the Friday prayers, people gathered to protest against Saudi Arabia's ongoing war on Yemen, demanding Prime Minister Imran Khan to use his influence to stop the Saudi war on Yemen.
Yemenis' chants are down with USA, down with Israel, and down with Al Saud. They're the best Muslims who are fighting with Israel and other US allies, sacrificing their children and loved ones. Those killing Yemenis are arranging anti-Islamic concerts in the Holy Land in the name of modernity, and even banned recently an Islamic preaching groups from India and Pakistan.
Yemen is facing an unequal war for more than 7 years now. The war has claimed tens of thousands of lives, many of them women and children.
Recently, we are witness that the Yemeni people are more than Palestinian and Kashmiris are oppressed. So it is our duty as a Pakistani, I feel that it's our obligatory duty to stand with the oppressed people of Yemen and to condemn all of the oppressors, including United States, European governments and their puppets, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and other allies.
Rights groups say while countries continue to turn a blind eye, there will be no end in sight to this horrendous conflict that has seen immeasurable suffering inflicted upon the men, women and children of Yemen. Yemenis have been knocking on all doors demanding accountability and justice. Member states owe it to them to take this forward at pace. The welfare of millions is in their hands. Protesters are outraged at the ongoing Saudi atrocities in Yemen. They are calling on the international community to take immediate actions and end the bloodshed. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson coming out fighting this week. Not the contrite, apologetic Prime Minister a week earlier over Partygate, allegations of rule-breaking parties under his roof during lockdown last year.
Even though these things are quite damaging, none of them constitute an artillery shell into his bunker. So that's why Boris is still alive and peddling his pipe.
Boris Johnson's list of problems have grown bigger in recent weeks as more images and allegations of illegal parties at his residence emerged. The result, an official inquiry and a police investigation. The former by senior civil servant Sue Gray. The outcome of those investigations are yet to be published, but the scandal is taking its toll. Apart from the opposition, some members of the Prime Minister's own Conservative Party have called for his head. Others say they're waiting on the Sue Gray report.
Well, of course, we all want to know the story, warts and all, but the police are saying that it would prejudice a police investigation. And much as we don't like that, nobody's going to be able to stop them taking the line that they choose to take. What I fully expect is that the Sue Gray report will reveal more of the same sort of antics.
While some MPs in the Prime Minister's Conservative Party sit on the fence, the Court of Public Opinion has already come up with a verdict.
If he's found to be guilty of these things, then I guess he's got to go.
He should quit. Very hypocritical from start to finish.
Just admit it and just say it happens.
He should resign.
That has meant plunging popularity ratings, a 32-point lead for Labour, meaning some Conservative MPs would face a near wipeout if a general election were to be held now. Add to that a cost of living crisis and fresh accusations of corruption over the funding of his Downing Street flat refurbishment.
It's hardly the first time Boris Johnson is having to wriggle through controversies, but the odds are very different this time. If he is found to have misled Parliament about those parties, he will be in breach of the so-called ministerial code. Saeed Poreza, London.
North Korea Thursday conducted a round of ballistic missiles testing, firing two short-range rockets off its east coast. Analysts suggest North Korean leader Kim Jong-un wants to show his people he's their defender, although the tests have several purposes.
They're trying to make a point regarding the South Korean presidential election. They're trying, I think, to try to intimidate South Koreans into thinking, look, you've got to come to terms with us, the North Koreans.
Since late 2017, North Korea has not conducted a long-range missile test or a nuclear test in the hopes of making a deal with former U.S. President Donald Trump on sanctions relief. No deal has materialized, and leader Kim has recently indicated the moratorium on long-range missile testing and nuclear testing has expired.
He said that he might want to go beyond simply testing missiles, implying, not saying directly, but implying that he might want to test an intercontinental ballistic missile, an ICBM, that's capable of carrying a warhead to the United States. And he might even want to have another underground nuclear test.
The U.S. has criticized the recent testing, while China places the blame for tensions on the U.S. reliance on sanctions on North Korea. South Koreans will head to the polls to elect a new president on March 9th, with North Korea conducting six rounds of missile tests in just the past month. Security, military affairs, and relations between Seoul and Pyongyang are likely to figure heavily in that election. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Shias in Italy, The Path of Minor Islam in Diaspora, is the title of a recent book which illustrates the role, practices, and ethnic composition of the Shia communities of Italy. The author is the Iranian expat and Palermo-based Minu Mishahwalad, an established academic researcher with a vast portfolio of publications on Islamic law and Iran's history. Mishahwalad's work was carried out in the span of 3 years in 13 different Italian cities, mostly in the north of Italy, where the bulk of the Shia communities reside.
A large number of Shias have moved to Italy's wealthy north for work-related reasons. According to rough estimations, they make up about 5 to 10% of the 2.5 million Muslims residing in Italy. The majority of them are from Pakistan, Iran, Afghanistan, and Lebanon. And then we have the Italians who have converted to Shia Islam.
Immigrants from Pakistan and the Indian subcontinent are very active in social events and religious rituals, such as the large Ashura ceremony in front of the Milan Central Station. However, also political activism is widespread, particularly among Shias living in Rome, with events organized in solidarity with the assassinated top Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani.
To our Shias generally organize more events and commemorations compared to Sunni Muslims residing in Italy. Another important aspect of my research shows how among the Shia faithfuls are today also a growing number of Italians. They have found in the Shia Islam a spiritual and political place where they can stand against the U.S. and Israeli's hegemony, where their traditional family values and love for artistic expression are welcomed.
About 2.5 million Muslims are living in Italy, making Islam the country's second largest religion. However, unlike Christianity and Judaism, Islam isn't formally recognized, meaning that mosques cannot receive public financing support, Islamic marriages have no legal force, and Muslim workers aren't entitled to take days off for religious festivities. Mishahwalad's research book also examines how Shia religious leaders in Italy interact with Shia religious authorities in a diasporic context. Max Civili, Rome.
It's what occupation looks like. U.S. troops wander around an independent country without any legal justification, invitation, or UN mandate. The U.S. officially intervened in Syria in 2014 under the pretext of fighting Daesh, something Syria dismisses as lies. The military prosecution in Syria held a press conference asserting it has collected evidence of U.S. Daesh cooperation in Syria.
The military prosecution in Syria obtained material evidence that the U.S. has almost direct control over Daesh and its terrorist activities in Syria using its illegal base in Al-Tanf. We have proof that many Daesh terrorists are being trained by U.S. forces in that base. We monitor the terrorists moving freely there with their weapons and vehicles.
For years, the U.S. has been looting Syria's oil after occupying areas in the oil-rich north and northeastern territories. The military prosecution in Syria vowed to judicially pursue the U.S. for all its crimes.
The result of our investigations into the U.S. violations in Syria, which led to destruction and casualties, threat to our sovereignty, theft of oil and wheat, illegitimate sanctions, and control over Daesh on territories of a U.N. member state, enables us in the near future to officially make accusations against the U.S. administration and its forces in Syria.
The military prosecution also accused the U.S. of promoting division by supporting a separatist ideology among the so-called SDF, providing them with weapons and ensuring they get all Syria's oil, let alone the U.S. airstrikes, which killed or displaced thousands of Syrians and destroyed its infrastructure. It hasn't been a day or two, a month or a year. It's been almost 8 uninterrupted years of U.S. violations in Syria, at least since the intervention of the U.S.-led coalition. But regardless of how much time they're planning to stay, Syrian officials don't spare a chance to reiterate that their country will be liberated from terrorism and illegal foreign presence. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Protests against a highly divisive bill have intensified in London as debates rage inside Westminster. The Nationality and Borders Bill has several controversial clauses which minority groups have accused of being racist and turning black and brown Brits into second-class citizens.
The fight over this clause is far from over. It remains in the House of Lords, who are debating the various controversial clauses which remain as part of this wide bill. Now, there is a lot of division to various clauses, and if the Lords decide that they want amendments to it, it will bounce back to Parliament.
The bill seeks to provide the Home Office with additional powers to revoke citizens' nationality status and deny access to refugees fleeing to Britain. The government have offered reassurances, with Home Secretary Priti Patel claiming the law would be used only in exceptional circumstances on people who pose the most risk to the UK. But critics find it hard to trust Number 10.
Trust is something that needs to be earned. It's not a right for the government to assume that they're going to have trust from its citizens, especially when they're putting something in which is so vague that it leaves too many interpretations open.
Priti Patel is actually quite a disgrace to her ancestors. As a migrant, she knows that she came from the backs of those who were colonised by the system. And now you create a bill to oppress those? I think that's pretty fascist for me. And just because she's got a little bit of power, she's forgotten who she's made from, where she comes from. And just because she sits with some people with privilege, I'm using my privilege to use it to create a change for other people. What is she doing?
Having been passed by MPs in the House of Commons last December, the bill is now going through the House of Lords, where peers are suggesting amendments. The bill likely won't become law for the next few months, leaving plenty of time for further protests. Robert Carter, London.
North Korea has confirmed its latest missile launches amid growing tensions with the United States over the country's nuclear weapons program. State media KCNA said one of the tests was an upgraded long-range cruise missile and the other a warhead of tactical guided missile. On Wednesday, the South Korean military said it detected the launch of two short-range ballistic missiles. Launches drew condemnation from the U.S. North Korea has recently said it will bolster its defenses against the U.S. and consider resuming all temporarily suspended activities.
Yemenis have marked the 40th day since Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government, Hassan Irloo, passed away. A mourning ceremony was held in the Iranian embassy in Yemen's capital Sana'a on the occasion.
Once again, we express our condolences to the Iranian people, our brothers, on the death of Mr. Hassan Irloo, who contributed a lot to the strengthening of the ties between Yemen and Iran.
In October 2020, Ilyich was appointed as Iran's ambassador to Yemen's National Salvation Government. In that portfolio, he focused his efforts on unifying resistance groups and strived for national reconciliation. He encouraged Yemeni political groups to resolve their internal disputes through dialogue. The senior diplomat also worked toward garnering international support for a mechanism that would end the Yemen conflict and lift the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition.
Everyone knows the stance of the Iranian people and the Iranian government, and that they stand with the Yemeni people against the Saudi-led war. Hajjasan Irlou was a great person. Despite the short period of Irlou's work in Yemen, he performed his duties to the fullest and contributed to the diplomatic process. When I met him in Iran, he used to tell me that he wished to visit Yemen, and thank God his wish came true, even if it was for a short time.
Ilyich was diagnosed with COVID-19 in mid-December, days before he was transferred to Tehran from Sana'a to receive medical treatment. But by the time he arrived at a hospital in Iran's capital, his condition had worsened irrevocably. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says that because certain countries delayed his flight out of Sana'a, Khatibzadeh did not name any country, but Saudi Arabia and its allies have been keeping Yemen under blockade since 2015.
Despite his short tenure as Iran's ambassador to Yemen, people who say the Iranian diplomat played a pivotal role in strengthening the brotherly ties between Tehran and Sana'a. They hold the Saudi-led coalition responsible for his death caused by the deliberate delay of his return home. Abdul Latif al-Washali from the Iranian embassy in Sana'a.
Stop the Saudi war on Yemen. This is what protesters demand as they gathered outside the United Nations office in Tehran. The rally came in reaction to last week's deadly airstrikes by the Saudi-led coalition that targeted a detention facility in Yemen. The United Nations did express its concern for the escalation of the conflict, but protesters here say it's not enough.
We gathered in front of the UN office to say that all of the crimes that are being committed against civilians are happening because the United Nations has given the Saudi criminals a green light by staying silent and watching.
For 7 years, the Yemeni nation has been facing the cruelest blockade and deadliest airstrikes, but no one is doing anything to help the Yemenis.
This time, besides targeting innocent people, Saudi Arabia also targeted the internet infrastructure to prevent their crimes from being reflected to the world. So we are the voices of our Yemeni brothers and sisters, and we are here to tell the world about the Saudi crimes.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched the war on Yemen in March 2015 with the goal of bringing former Yemeni President Abdurrabbuh Mansur Hadi back to power. Yemen's Ansarullah movement, along with the army, leads the anti-Saudi resistance in the country. These people say, despite Riyadh's strong logistic support from the U.S. and U.K., Yemen has made headways against the Saudi invaders and left the kingdom and its allies bogged down in the country.
The enemy is facing a hard time. Saudi Arabia tried its best and plundered its money on American and British weapons to bring our nation to its knees. But our resistance has burst their bubble, and as you see, they are resorting to barbaric ways to achieve their evil goals. But we keep resisting until our land is free.
The ongoing bombardment of civilian facilities has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and destroyed the infrastructure of the impoverished country, not to mention the spread of infectious diseases and famine. Saudi Arabia has also imposed an all-out blockade against Yemen, which blocks the entry of humanitarian and medical supplies into the war-torn country.
The Saudi war on Yemen is slammed here as a crime against humanity, a crime that these people say continues to be ignored by the responsible entities in the world. Protesters here say it's time for the UN to do more than condemning the crimes committed by Riyadh and take action to bring the Yemeni suffering to an end. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Harsh winter, hunger, and poverty have impacted daily lives across Afghanistan, with children worst hit by the difficulties combined with malnourishment and famine. According to the United Nations Children's Agency, more than 1 million children in Afghanistan are at the risk of severe malnutrition and death this year.
The agency called on Afghan partners and donors to take practical steps to prevent the catastrophe.
We work here to provide our family with food and money. My father is alive, but he is jobless. Some of us are orphans and sole breadwinners of our families. It is very cold, but we have to come here and work.
It is cold, but we take to the streets for work. We polish boots or sell gum and flowers. I have a family of five. Me and my brother are our family's breadwinners. We have no way out.
Here in Indira Gandhi Hospital, as the doctors say, the number of malnourished children has more than doubled since poverty is on the rise in Afghanistan.
Malnutrition has a direct relation with the economic and financial situation of the people. The more people get poor, the more our patients increase. As you know, the recent sanctions and aid cut have affected our people's economy, so we are receiving more and more patients.
The economic situation has worsened among all Afghan children. Our children are being malnourished due to the shortage of food and nutrition in our country. I call on the world to help Afghan families.
According to the UN, only 2% of the population of Afghanistan are getting enough food to eat, and half the population are facing severe hunger. Almost 5 months after the US-led international coalition hastily abandoned Afghanistan, millions of Afghans are teetering at the brink of starvation. The US and its allies have cut off Afghanistan's access to international aid and froze roughly $10 billion in assets belonging to the country's central bank since August after the Taliban took over of the war-torn country. The UN had already warned that millions of Afghans could run out of food before the onset of harsh winter, and around 1 million children were at risk of starvation and death. 20 years of war and the US sanctions have led millions of Afghans to the brink of starvation. Children in particular are paying the price of conflicts and crises in their country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to yet another edition from series of Q&A in Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Those who have been listening to this series of shows, they are quite familiar with the current that we have in this series of shows. We are trying to answer doubts and misconceptions that we receive from different questioners from around the world. And for that, we invite Islamic researchers, scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers. As usual, we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi, Islamic researcher and scholar from Qom Seminary Schools, to help us in this show. He is the guest of us in this studio. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for accepting the invitation. Dear listeners, brothers and sisters, we are still talking about the question which was posed in our last show concerning the death penalty and death sentence in Islamic societies. And it was asked that why do we have this sentence and penalty in Islamic communities? The respected guest speaker of the show, Sheikh Murtada, said first, it is not in abundance. Second, there are only in four cases, that two of the cases are accepted universally by different, let's say, followers of different religions and even secular people. But the rest, the remaining two, are the ones that we are going to discuss in depth to see that sentence which is coming because of the punishment for some sins, and also death penalty that comes for retaliation. So we are trying to talk about these two, inshallah, today in depth and talk about the philosophy of such rulings in Islam. Sheikh, I know you are still waiting to have your viewpoints on that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for that summary. We talked about one of the important cases of death penalty. We said that one of them is related to qisas and retaliation, and we said that it's a right of the heirs of that person. It's not, a religious punishment from Islamic perspective. Islam gives this right to the people, and at the same time encourages them to forgive, if mm-hmm. possible. Now, we come to the next, category of the death penalty, and that is related to the punishments which Islam mentions for some of the sins.
Mm-hmm.
When we refer to the verses of the Quran, we come to this understanding that only one case is mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran, and the other cases are mentioned in the narrations. Quickly speaking, let me refer to some of these sins that, according to the religion of Islam, the punishment is the death penalty.
Yeah.
Of course, for all of them, there are many conditions, many details that, those who are interested, they need to refer to the books of jurisprudence. So I'm not saying that for, any case that this happened, that the punishment is death penalty. No. There are many conditions for each one of them. For example, one of them is adultery, which means, when two people, one of them being married, they, commit adultery, again, with many conditions which are mentioned. There are many exceptions to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is sodomy, a form of homosexuality. Apostasy is another one. Those people who claim to be prophets. And then we have some cases, for example, a person commits an act, and for three times he is punished by the Islamic government,
mm-hmm.
and then he repeats for the fourth time, and then he would be, the punishment for that, for the fourth time, is the death penalty.
True.
Now, these are some of the cases, and many of these countries which, they attack the religion of Islam, they are talking about these cases, why we have death penalty in the religion of Islam regarding these so-called great sins. Again, I would like to repeat the point that although we have death penalty in Islam, but the approach of Islam toward this penalty is not a positive one.
Very true.
And the approach is negative one.
Yeah.
What is approving this point is that as I mentioned, there are a couple of cases for which the punishment is the death penalty. But let's refer and let's read the history of Islam. How many cases do we have and are recorded in the history of Islam at the time of the Prophet and the next Imam, Imam Ali alayhi salam, and next Imam, in which, for example, it is mentioned that a person has been sentenced to death penalty by the Prophet for committing adultery,
mm-hmm.
or for committing sodomy, or for apostasy, or for claiming to be a prophet, and for magician, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So this is a very important point. I ask all those people who attack the religion of Islam that there are many death penalties in Islam, refer to the books of history, and bring all the cases which tell us that, okay, on that very day, the Holy Prophet killed that person because he committed or she committed adultery or sodomy, and so on and so forth. So now there might seem a...
You mean the law was available and it was not practiced?
Yeah, that's the point. It seems that there is a kind of contradiction here. We have this punishment mentioned in the Quran for one of them and for the rest in the narrations, but it's not practiced. Is it a contradiction between the law and the conduct of the Prophet and the Imam?
What is the reason?
The point is that what I mentioned, the death penalty is there in Islamic laws, but the approach of Islam is not that positive, which means that the main reason for mentioning these, death penalty as the punishment for some of these great sins is to prevent people from committing them. just to, I mean, warn the people to away from these great sins. According to the religion of Islam, adultery is not, a light sin, so to speak, or the other cases which I mentioned. All of these cases are great sins. But the punishments which are mentioned, the main function of this punishment, I mean, this penalty, is to prevent people, to warn the people. When people know that if this sin is approved in an Islamic court, then the punishment is death penalty, for sure they would be away from that. I mean, they try to be away from that as much as possible. Now, what is the, Islam's solution? The solution of Islam is that, I mean, to remove this contradiction, is that it's so difficult for these great sins to be approved for an Islamic judge.
Mm-hmm.
So for each and every one of them, Islam has, set a set of rules and conditions to be proved. For example, four witnesses should come, all of them at the same time and place, and all of them mention all the details in the same way that these two people committed adultery. They should be just people.
That it will never happen.
Not never, but it hardly happens.
It hardly happens. Definitely.
Yeah.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
So, does it mean that that punishment, that death penalty, doesn't have any positive rule? Effect? For sure it has, because at the end of the day, it is possible for that to be proved.
Yeah.
So people will be away from that.
Mm-hmm.
But practically speaking, it's very difficult. But people are not sure that, it will not be proof for them. So it has this effect of preventing people from committing that sin. When we refer to the Sira, the lifestyle of the Prophet, we see the same, that a person comes to the Prophet and he confesses that I've committed adultery. The Holy Prophet somehow tries to tell that person, no, maybe you are, telling nonsense, you have done another, you didn't commit this sin, or you may come the other day, and so on and so forth. So the Holy Prophet, because...
He wanted to actually make him not confess what he did.
Yeah. Because it should be confessed four times, then it will be proved. So it has another message too. Through this way, the Holy Prophet and the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt did not want the greatness of these sins to be taken as light by the people. Imagine on a daily basis, people come to you and confess that they have committed adultery, and every day they are, killed. So gradually speaking, the greatness, the seriousness of this sin is not, taken into consideration anymore. But when people know that it is so great that even the Holy Prophet does not people to come to him and confess, it means that they should take this sin seriously.
Yeah.
The same has been mentioned in the, regarding our first Imam, Imam Hajar al-Salam, and the fact that a lady came to Imam Hajar al-Salam. For the first day, Imam Harisan asked her a couple of questions and then, told her to come the other day. And for each day, Imam Harisan tried his best to, bring some, ways out for that lady to not to be punished for committing adultery. So my point is that the punishment of death penalty is there, but the approach of Islam is not toward proving these sins in an Islamic court. The main function of these punishments, the death penalty, is to prevent the people from committing those sins.
And the ruler of the Islamic Ummah tries to prevent them from breaking the ugliness of this sort of sins.
Exactly, that's the point. There are a couple of points that I would like to share also, because those people who are against this penalty, they say that life is the divine gift to human beings, and no one has the right, no country, no government has the right to take...
Except Allah himself, that he is the creator.
And the answer to that is that, okay, what is your solution? They say that imprisonment, and you may say that freedom is also a divine gift, so why do you take this divine blessing from the people? At the end of the day, there might be a solution for, I mean, preventing people from committing the
sin. So why, Sheikh, why life imprisonment is not enough for a person who killed somebody, but he will be deprived of being in society for the rest of his life? So it can